Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I have the privilege and honor today of speaking with Jenna Robinson. Jenna is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, where she has worked in various capacities since 2007. She was also previously at the John Locke Foundation. She served on a number of boards, such as the Alumni Free Speech Alliance, the Bastiat Society of Raleigh, the Board of Visitors at UNC Chapel Hill, and previously on the North Carolina Advisory Committee for the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the Classical Liberals in the Carolinas. She received her MA and PhD in political science from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and has taught courses in American politics at UNC Chapel Hill, Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and Wake Technical Community College. Robinson's work has appeared in Investor's Business Daily, Roll Call, Forbes, American Thinker, Human Events, Carolina Journal, and the Raleigh News and Observer, and she lives in Cary, North Carolina with her husband and two sons. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me today.
Now, if you could, let's just start with a brief explanation of what the Martin Center is and what it aims to do.
Sure. So the Martin Center is a nonprofit think tank here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And our goal is to find solutions to the critical issues in higher education that can be solved via public policy. And specifically, public policy that can be implemented by state legislatures and boards of trustees. Obviously, there is a lot going on at the federal level with higher education, and the federal government controls a lot of what higher education does simply because it funds it in such an overwhelming way. There's such a lot of federal money flowing into higher education. But there is also a lot of state money and state governance going on in higher education. About 80% of all post-secondary students are attending public institutions. And so we think that if we want to improve higher education, public policy is the way to reach the most students in the most efficient way.
And I've been reading the website off and on for years. I have one article published on there, I think. I don't remember what it was on, but I know I did it. And it's a great place for conversations on higher ed, probably one of the best places I know of on the internet for these conversations, frankly. And you recently, I was sent this blueprint of reform that focuses on teacher education specifically. And I know this is one of the areas of public policy you're interested in focusing on. Can you tell us a little bit about what that particular blueprint is aiming to do and what you hope it accomplishes?
Sure. So that blueprint is laying out first the problem, and that is that our students in K-12 schools across the country are performing really abysmally in both reading and math. Our blueprint focuses a little bit more on the reading side. But our conclusion is that schools of education are at least partially responsible for this failure to learn, because schools of education are where teachers are learning their trade. That's where they're learning to teach. It's where they're learning what is important. And we think that schools of education have been largely focusing on the wrong things. And in our blueprint for reform, we really hone in on their failure to teach reading. And we think that's so important because, I mean, obviously reading is fundamental, as the saying goes, but it really is. Students must learn to read if they're going to continue learning, you know, throughout K-12. And into college. And if they're weak readers, it has all these downstream effects. And so by focusing on that fundamental skill of not just kind of learning how sounds are pronounced, but learning how to be a good reader, a reader who comprehends what they're reading. That's what we're trying to fix. And that's what we've got really focused on in this blueprint.
Well, maybe let's elaborate on that a little bit. What about the current paradigm of teaching to read is problematic in your view? The data obviously is unambiguous, quite frankly, on the poor performance in terms of the literacy levels, and especially in public education. But what specifically is going on in these education schools that you find problematic about the way they're teaching how to read?
All right. So you just said that the data are unambiguous on the poor reading. The other place where data are unambiguous is that the best way to teach reading is through what we now call the science of reading. And the science of reading it's very phonics based. It has five pillars: phonemic awareness, phonics, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. And these five pillars are just not being taught. Instead of teaching a phonics-based curriculum and a content-based curriculum, schools of education are doing what they call either balanced literacy or whole language. And both of those are meant to be more child-centered, more holistic, more kind of experimental. You guess at the words as you're trying to read them if you're a student. And from all the data, we know that these things just don't work. We also think that there are some trends in higher education and in education schools specifically that are undermining student achievement. So the focus on social emotional learning, for example, mm-hmm. Is telling students everything is good. All your guesses are equally valid. We're more concerned about your social emotional well-being than whether you can actually read. And this is a distraction. And as I said, it undermines the goal of having students actually achieve reading fluency.
It's interesting. The way you put that, I think, is excellent, because there's an element of it's education has become excessively therapy driven. And I'm not hating on therapy itself, but that, we're teaching students, and we are teachers. We're trying to form them intellectually, but we're not therapists. And so, in a way, if you're developing pedagogically a system of teaching how to read, like, look, just do what feels best to you, and don't do anything to stretch you or challenge you too much, because you might get discouraged, you might get frustrated, you might cry, right? It's not so much the opposite of tough love, but it's also it's a focus on I just want you to feel good at the end of the day, rather than I want you to be smarter. Is that kind of what's going on? Because the way you described it kind of made me think of Rousseau and the Emile. It made me think of just some of these other philosophies where it's that the emotional disposition of the student is more important than whether or not they actually advance intellectually. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah, that's absolutely what's going on. And I think you're right to bring up Rousseau and Emile, because when you talk about these other philosophies, even if you talk about whole language, it's meant to be a more natural way to learn. That's how it's sold in schools of education. And that's how it was sold to the American public, that it's natural and it's working with the students' own instincts and that they're going to pick this up on their own. And so it is sold as this kind of holistic, child-centered, emotional way to teach, rather than focusing on the goals that have to be achieved. And I think that that's a mistake, because it's not serving the students if they leave the third grade classroom without a real fluency in education. All the data show that if students can't read well by the third grade, they will be behind for the rest of their time in school.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an obvious thing. Although the whole language, they'll just learn this naturally. That whole idea, I mean, it also kind of comes back to a lot of, we don't have to go into this, but different philosophies of parenting and just what it means to be a human person. Are you Are you naturally good and just born with everything that you need, or do you need to, and society corrupts you, and then, you know, the systems corrupt you, and so you just need to break free of those, and if you just naturally learn, everything will be okay? Well, not necessarily. I think both as parents and as teachers, we recognize that, look, we're born in some ways, I mean, from a Christian standpoint, it's about original sin and brokenness, and we need to be developed and redeemed and taught and formed in different ways. And that a lot of the modern educational philosophy isn't operating on that same paradigm. But at the same time, I think, you know, one of the things that would be missing in this is you don't start from this position of, how do I put this, kind of a antagonism toward the nature of the kid or the heart of the kid, right? Or of the student. And I think that's what's missing in a lot of these conversations is like, look, when we say that kids come to our schools in need of an education and development and formation, we're not saying that they're somehow like, we're not demeaning them. We're saying we believe in you as a human person, and we believe you can be something more. We're not, and this is what Rousseau got so wrong in my view, and also John Dewey and others, is that, you know, when we say these things, we're not demeaning the child. We're not limiting them. We're saying we believe that if you live according to these rules and that there are these structures that you can follow toward a more fulfilling, meaningful, successful, healthier life. In that respect, does that make sense?
It does. And I think I want to kind of draw the distinction between things that students learn naturally and things that they don't, because I think that this whole language and social emotional learning and this very kind of natural focused education, like, it comes from a well-meaning place. Parents see babies learn how to roll over on their own, or right, learn how to crawl on their own, or even learn how to talk on their own by watching and mimicking the adults around them. And so then there's this assumption that, well, everything then can be taught in this way, where students just follow their curiosity and they will learn it. But reading is not a natural phenomenon. Reading is part of culture. It's part of something that we developed in order to pass on knowledge. And so it really is in a different realm of education. It is in the realm of things that must be taught and really needs to be taught in a systematic way so that students are getting the most from it. I mean, anyone who's studied the English language for any time at all will notice immediately that it makes no sense. And so actually teaching it and giving students directed instruction so that they can recognize the words, recognize the sounds, understand why some words are pronounced phonetically and other words are not. That's something that you have to take a lot of care to do correctly. Students are not going to pick it up in the same way that they pick up speaking.
Right. And it also doesn't operate according to any logic like mathematics does, right? I know my son, who will be 13 this year, he gets frustrated learning like that word means this and this at the same time. It just makes no sense. Who did that? And he gets to this mindset where clearly there was a conspiracy to make people mad, that the only explanation for why this is that English is frustrating because someone wanted to make it this way. No, son, that's not the way it is. I just blame the French usually, but that's a different story. Of course, the other thing too is if you're thinking about trying to learn a language, the idiom, the weird phrases, I can't think of one off the top of my head. Well, off the top of my head, doesn't really make sense. Right. I mean, literally that's not what's going on here. But trying to come to a language and adapt to those idioms, would be very, very difficult. You know, one of the things that I was interested in looking at the blueprint was, and we're already kind of getting at it here, is this philosophy of education. Do we know if, you know, the modern teacher education school, do they get into a philosophy of education at all, or like debate it, or do they simply impose a uniform one?
They impose a uniform philosophy of education. There is no discussion about different philosophies. If you look through School of Education required courses, you always see things on diversity, equity, and inclusion. You see social emotional learning. And Dewey has a lot of influence in these schools of education. Things like direct instruction or, you know, classical education are not brought up in a typical school of education. I think that's why now in kind of the good news, we are seeing these alternative programs pop up where students can learn to be a teacher in a classical setting, because the legacy schools of education are not doing it.
Yeah, it's so sad. There's so many good things to read in the world of philosophy of education. I mean, we could have conferences upon conferences on it. And it really, when you discuss the philosophy of education, you're forced to confront so many other deeper questions about what we mean by the human person, what we mean by, you know, the end goals of life, you know, the role of faith, the role of reason, all these things, that if you just go into teaching, taking that stuff for granted, you're going to miss out on such a richer, more meaningful experience, both as a teacher and as a student, I think. I think it's unfortunate that it's missing.
Now, absolutely. I think that richness has really been stripped out.
And it's also why I wonder if it's in part why there's some statistic, I don't know if it's true or not, and I can't remember where I saw this, but like the number one activity that teachers do on their day off is look for another job, because they're burnt out. Now, I think there's a lot to do with, there's a lot that's going on with this. Not only is it, you know, are they questioning why am I doing this at all, but you know, there is the issue of pay in certain places, although increasing the pay hasn't necessarily solved the problem. And there's also the one of the elephants in the room for all of this to me is we can reform teacher education a lot, right? And we can have these philosophy debates about philosophy of education, but the challenges that so many of these students face in their families and in their homes, which we as teachers cannot control, is taking a massive toll on what we can even accomplish at all. I mean, I don't know if there's, and I think that's part of why this kind of more therapeutic aspect of teaching has been, you know, often comes from good motives. Like these teachers see their students coming in every day very, very, you know, despondent, or they're coming from broken homes. They're coming from, in many cases, poverty. You know, do you really want to heap more reading on them? Right. I mean, does that resonate a little bit with this? So the kind of the struggle here is that some of these students, especially in public schools, they're coming from situations where it just seems like, you know, do we really want to make them read, you know, the Iliad, or, you know, or make this harder? If
right,
that makes sense.
Right. No, I think that does make sense. You know, teachers see, and people who are running schools see, that there's a lot of their students' lives are hard already. And so they don't want to make it harder. I do think that's, you know, somewhat misguided, because as you mentioned before, these works, that's the richness in education. And so I think it's harder if you haven't taught them to read well in the beginning. So that's true, but it's also richer. And so what they've done in stripping out the richness and replacing it with, you know, excerpts from documents, they've stripped out the kind of the meaning in mm-hmm. education. I don't think any student or any teacher gets excited over reading an excerpt from, you know, from a nonfiction book. Mm-hmm. That is not what inspires a good teacher to get up every day, is reading, you know, two paragraphs out of the biology textbook and then testing reading comprehension on that.
Right.
That is, and that is where a lot of the testing in reading has gone, where we get these excerpts instead of whole books. I spoke with one of my interns a few years ago, asking her, and this was her college class, one of her college literature classes, you know, what are you reading in your class? And she said, well, we don't read a whole book at all throughout the year. We're just reading parts of books. And she said that was her experience in high school as well. They did read some books, but it was kind of few and far between, because they're more focused on just the skills learning rather than providing that rich curriculum.
Yeah, and I think there's this could be a whole discussion of its own, but is there, what is the cost of abridging things over and over again, right? What are we losing in the midst of that? Are we creating a habit of, well, are we in it unintentionally teaching that a lot of what is written is superfluous? And of course, I guess that is true in some respects, but there's also a sense in which, like, we need to see the whole picture, right? It's like, would you do an abridgment of works of art, right? Would you, if you were looking at the Last Supper, the painting, and you only saw half of it, like, that just doesn't seem right, right? The same thing is true with these books. You need to see them as a whole. And yes, some of it might be poorly done, especially in a book, oftentimes, but especially the great books. I mean, I'm struggling with this with my own kids. It's like, do I get the abridgment of the Iliad and the Odyssey? Some people are listening and saying, no, don't do it. And I'm wrestling with it because I'm like, I don't know if I can keep their attention.
So I think that what students are getting from this practice is, one, their attention spans are just in the garbage. All of us. It's not just students, it's all of us, especially with our technical world. But you make it worse if you have them only ever read excerpts. They don't learn to develop the habit of attention. You're also teaching them that books don't matter, the works don't matter. The only thing that matters is your ability to figure out what a paragraph means. And so you're not ever concerned about the content of the work. You're only concerned about the structure of the work. Do you know what individual words mean? And I think that's a real loss. And I want to take that back to the original reading instruction, because something we didn't touch on is that vocabulary and comprehension are extremely important for the reading instruction when students are very young. And Edie Hirsch, who is one of the people who I think has done excellent work in this area, he cites an experiment in one of his books where students were quizzed. They were given a little se a segment, of course, to read about a baseball game. And students were quizzed afterwards on their reading comprehension. And what they found is that it wasn't the technically proficient readers who did the best. The students who did the best were the students who knew something about baseball. And so what that tells us is that foundational knowledge, that background knowledge, is absolutely essential to reading and to comprehension. And so by giving students little snippets of, dozens of different things, you're never giving them that background knowledge. You're just giving them, words.
I
And
wonder
so they're really missing on a lot that they need to thrive.
it kind of goes back to the whole ideology of scientism to a point where I don't know if that's I don't even know if that's the right word, but science within the sciences, and I want to see if there's other aspects of this beyond reading. Obviously, reading is the most important. I agree with you here, but there's also this element of the this is not a word, but the scientification of everything, where in order to understand a paragraph, you have to understand the words, you have to understand the punctuation, where you're stripping away the context so much, right? You're zeroing in on this little itty bitty piece, the way a scientist might do just to understand one part of a cell, right? But the truth is, and this is where we lose something. That, yeah, you can focus on that one word here and there, but you're never gonna understand enough unless you step back and see the forest, right? Don't just look at the trees, see the forest, see the region it's in, right? When was this book written? Who is the author? What is the larger context in which this book, in which this excerpt is in? I mean, yeah, it's striking to me how we've in an attempt to see things more sharply, at least in theory, we've actually done the opposite. We've actually obscured a lot by removing all this extra context and stuff, right? That background knowledge that you were talking about, right?
Right. I think, and we see this in universities as well, which of course is where schools of education live, where the focus is only on skills. It's never on content. If you look at a general education curriculum these days, instead of teaching history and requiring students to take a class in history, they're now taking a class in historical analysis. And so they're just teaching students historical analysis. And the actual history class that you choose as the student doesn't matter, according to the university. You know, you can take a survey course in Western civilization, or you can take a course about, you know, one tiny little snippet of history in one very discrete place. So you could do, you know, the American West. And they treat those as exactly the same, because all they're interested in is the skill of historical analysis. How do you read like a historian? Instead of caring that, you know, students know where they come from and they know, you know, everything that happened to get us to this place, into this culture. And so, and I think that is coming kind of from the sciences in a way, because sciences are about the scientific method,
right?
Things you can measure, things that are kind of, they have discrete variables. And so I think that some of the changes we've seen in both K-12 and higher education are coming from the humanities and even social sciences trying to be more like the natural sciences.
Now, if we did, you know, let's say teacher education, you know, makes this shift away from kind of the skills to the content. And that's kind of what you're going for, right? Did that more content focused teacher education?
Right. So we want more content focused, but we also want the absolutely fundamental skill of learning to read to be done excellently. If you don't get that right, then, you know, students can't absorb that other content that you're going to ask them to read down the road.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things, though, and I could see, is I'm on the same page as you with this, but let's pretend I'm not for a second, because you and I both got our PhDs in political science, right? We know what we're doing. We go into college and we know our content, but, you know, now we have to put together exams. We have to do some kind of assessment because someone asked us, you know, that's the A word, right, in college education, at least for professors. We have to do some kind of assessment. We have to structure a syllabus and some kind of system of learning. I don't know what it was like at UNC, but at least for my experience, no one taught me how to be a college professor, right? It was, you know, this is how you do research. This is the content you need to know, the books you need to read. Be really, really smart, Josh, and then just go teach. You know, is there a danger, you know, if we don't, where does pedagogy come in, if at all, right? Do we risk losing something if we only focus on that content-driven approach? Right. So to go back to your historian, right? If they take a bunch of required history courses and then they go to teach high school history, how do we make sure that they're still a good teacher? Does that make sense?
Right. Right. No, I think it absolutely is important to teach pedagogy along with the content. I think it's just schools of education have gotten it very lopsided for a long time. It's all pedagogy and sometimes bad pedagogy and no content or very little content. And to the point that some teachers will say they feel uncomfortable teaching particular topics because they say they just don't know enough about it. Mm-hmm. So we need to get that balance right. And for the record, my experience at UNC was a lot like yours. I did have one class where they taught us to create syllabi and do put together tests and these other things, but it wasn't political science specific. It was for all graduate students. And so it was helpful, but I probably could have used some more tips.
Yeah. I mean, what I ended up doing, just copying. And I mean, I asked friends like, hey, what did you do? You know, and they would give me a syllabus and I would just, you know, personalize it to my style and my thinking. But yeah, I mean, without the help of friends, I'm not sure I would have gotten to a complete syllabus. But I don't miss that part, I'll be honest with you. Now, one of the challenges I think we see here You know, so Ciceronian Society is a Christian organization, but when we're proposing these policy initiatives, we're proposing them to a secular context that doesn't agree on the answer to the question of what the education is for at all. You know, is it merely for career preparation and training? Is it to make money and acquire power, to put it really crudely? Is it something more noble, or is it something more philosophical? Is it connected to who we are as a human person? I think in these efforts to improve the education of teachers, can we answer that question? I mean, can we bring that up? What is education for at all?
I think we can bring that up.
Okay.
So the Martin Center is secular, and the way we put it in our mission statement, so we're trying to reform higher education, including schools of education. And we put it that higher education should equip students to flourish in their careers, embrace responsible citizenship, and grow as seekers of wisdom. And I think that that's true no matter what faith tradition that you come from. Obviously, depending on your faith, growing as a seeker of wisdom is going to look different. If you are you know, Christian, it's going to look different than if you are an atheist or agnostic. But I think that wanting students to grow as seekers of wisdom is a universal statement that we can wrestle with. But yeah. I think that even in a public school, in a public forum, we can talk about what does it mean to be wise? Where do we look to find that out? You know, what philosophy could we consider if we want to seek wisdom? And so I think you can ask those questions and consult a variety of texts from, you know, religious and non-religious writers to address those questions. And so I absolutely think the purpose of education should be on the table for students in public settings, because we didn't create schools in this country. You know, going back, you talk about the creation of universities, creation of schools. It was never initially just to be career centered.
Right.
It was always about citizenship. And our, you know, a lot of our universities, especially, were for religious purposes. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very important to have that conversation. It can't be all career driven.
Right.
But I also want to push back and say that even the universities and the schools that say they're preparing students for careers, if you ask employers, how are they doing? Employers will say, not as well as we want them to.
Yeah.
So I think there is value in schools focusing on these other things, you know, obviously in and of themselves, but also as preparation for careers.
Right. Well, and I would point out too, I remember being in this soul crushing faculty meeting once where these education consultants showed up to the school I was at the time, and they're giving a list of these different careers and the process, the likelihood that these careers will be, you know, lucrative, or that they're promising, or these areas of industry and employment are growing, and et cetera, et cetera. And they're using it's data driven. And so like they're using that to determine the value of a given major. Right. So like for, you know, so there's not a lot of historians out there. So the history major must be of low value because, you know, the likelihood of someone getting a degree in history and actually working in history is seemingly low, right? But then the point I would make was that so much of this career-driven education, which again, they're not doing well anyway, was that they missed the point of how dynamic, especially the modern economy is, that so many of the jobs that the students in school today will take or have or pursue don't even exist yet. It's changing all the time. And so having a kind of well-rounded education where you can read well and write well and speak well and relate to others and develop knowledge of any content for that matter, I think is so crucial, because that prepares you for a life of whatever happens, right? It's not an education for a specific career. It's an education for a life well lived. And I think that's something that that secular or sacred could get behind.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it used to be true that employers, you know, loved to take on English majors because they knew that they had been taught to reason well.
Right.
I don't know if that's true anymore. But I think that, I'm of two minds about this focus on return on investment in different majors,
Okay.
because if students are taking on a large amount of debt,
Right.
I understand why they are concerned about whether their degree is going to translate into a job.
Yeah.
And we do see big differences between, say, an engineering degree and a history degree.
Of course, yeah.
And so it becomes important when, your ability to, pay off your debt, buy a house, move on with your life is in question. And so I think that, students do have to be savvy in what they decide to study. But I also agree that the liberal arts can prepare students for, a wide variety of jobs. It's not going to prepare you for to be an engineer, which requires very specific, specialized education.
Right.
But it does open a lot of doors. And I think that we've lost sight of that.
Yeah, the debt the debt thing is that's a sore subject in the in the Bowman home. But yeah, 'cause I there's so much about that, especially with grad school. It's just not, in so many instances, I would agree with you that the return on investment, it's not worth going into debt for. I'm grateful for what I got to learn and read and do and see and people I got to meet. But at the same time, if you'd have told me that I would be, the executive director of the only employee of a nonprofit at age 39, I would have laughed at you. Like, what? What am I doing all this for then? But going back to this what is education for? Because when I'm reading on the Martin Center, one of the concerns that you and I share is this. What is essentially indoctrination in teacher education programs. But I also was thinking of a challenge we have here in promoting these different policy reforms as being against indoctrination. So what, in other words, what's the distinction between indoctrination and education generally? Because no matter how you define that, especially from a critical theory perspective, which is so much part of the teacher education schools, it's necessarily indoctrination, however you're going to answer that. Because once you start to draw lines and define things, to even have a concept of right, wrong, good, true, and beautiful, to have a concept of wise, right, as you put it, or to pursue wisdom, what is wisdom, is to impose on someone's, from the critical theory perspective, autonomy. And that autonomy from freedom from tradition or being defined by any system or person outside the almighty self. That's really the goal of critical theory, but I don't want to go down that rabbit trail. What I'm asking is, how do we make a distinction between indoctrination and genuine education without just going in circles?
Right. So I think, one of the questions you asked early on about pedagogy is a partial answer to this. Is the School of Education teaching just one pedagogy, or is there a conversation about it? And I think the presence of conversations means it's less likely to be indoctrination. I'm tempted to be like the Supreme Court and say I know it when I see it, but I'll try to answer more than that. And so I think you do need to have, especially in the public setting, you need to have viewpoint diversity. And so in the educational setting, there should be pedagogical diversity. If you have pedagogical diversity in the School of Education, then the future teachers can look at those different pedagogies for themselves and figure out, what works, both, by looking at the data and by thinking about, how these pedagogies line up with their own understanding of human nature. And so I think that is what I would encourage. Also, in the public setting, I think one of the things we've tried to do with policy is remove these mandatory indoctrination
Right.
activities. So you can't have a person sign essentially a statement of politics or a statement of faith at a secular public university.
Right.
You can't require that for future students or future faculty. And so getting anything that's compelling people to make these value statements, you've got to get rid of that.
Well, at least in secular education, I understand why, obviously Christian education does it. There's a doctrinal line that we're drawing, but in secular education, if it's going to remain public and secular, then there's, do we, if you draw these certain lines, and you're moving toward that indoctrination piece, and frankly, as I think you're in intimating here, is that there's. In secular education, there might as well be certain value and value statements or statements of faith, for lack of a better word, in these teacher education programs, especially with kind of diversity, equity, inclusion as they're defining it, right? Which is essentially informed by critical theory itself, right? The very kind of a hostility to tradition, a suspicion of all power and authority, or anything that might. External to the self that's defining me. And so as a way of it ends up becoming its own kind of faith, which is what Marxism was anyway, in a way. It's kind of a Christian heresy without Christ. That's a different philosophical conversation, but I mean, is that kind of what you're getting at? Is that we understand that there's already there's a statement of values and faith that is happening in these schools of education. They're just not calling it that all the time.
Right. No, they're calling it right now. They're calling it a DEI statement.
Right.
In the future, there might be some other piece of dogma that people are expected to sign on to. And I think that outside of a religious institution, that just has no place. Universities build themselves as a place where it is a marketplace of ideas where students can learn critical thinking, learn to examine different ideas and come to their own conclusions and explore knowledge and discover knowledge. And if you shut that down by asking students to come in with a certain philosophy from which they must not deviate right at the outset, I think that you're not living up to that promise of open inquiry.
And I would argue, I'm this again, this would take the podcast a lot longer. I think you can still do some of that open inquiry in the context of a statement of faith as well. So I guess I'm not saying we need to put that in a secular school, by the way. I'm not saying that. I think there is that, I think free inquiry can still happen at a school that has a statement of faith and a statement of values, especially if one of those values is humility and as well as hospitality. And because as a Christian, there are certain things I believe very, very strongly and very, very confidently. But I also would say that there's an element of saying, like, look, we live in a world where people don't agree with me on these things, and we are also called to love them. So let's also understand what they have to say and what they're thinking, right? I think there is a way in which we can have value statements and of this nature that is open to inquiry and these things. With DEI, one of the things that I found was, especially that's informed by critical theory, is that you get to a point where there's just certain perspectives that are just not allowed at all, right? Like this is just shut down already because it was the dominant one, right? Or because it was popular before we discovered critical theory, right?
Right. I think one of the ones that is most antithetical to the university setting is that critical theory rejects empiricism, which is what the sciences are founded on. And so it's really just incompatible with the kind of instruction and the kind of learning that's going on in a university setting. And so that, I think, is my particular, a particular problem with critical theory, DEI, that mindset is that it really does set itself up to be incompatible with the university. But I agree with you. Having watched education and been part of education at Christian universities as an observer and as an occasional adjunct professor, I know that good conversations can happen in places where students and faculty have signed that statement of faith. You can still have inquiry. Because as you mentioned, the part of the philosophy is intellectual humility and understanding we don't know it all. And so you still can have very vibrant conversations.
I want to bring up a theme that's near and dear to the Ciceronian society, and it gets to something you started off with at first is you're trying to influence state level policy in particular. And so to what extent might these, and so the theme is place, and to what extent might these teacher education and teacher education, teacher prep reforms come back to that notion of place? Because if I go off to learn how to be a teacher in North Carolina and then come back here to where I currently live in Michigan, yeah, I may have some subject-based knowledge, that's great, but is there something distinctive about being a teacher in a given place? And I wonder if, and this is, you know, a topic of conversation, have we lost something by constantly sending people to learn how to be teachers and then actually be teachers in places they're not originally rooted in, right? You know, to what extent does teacher education, can teacher education reform think about this concept of place, where there are certain things that are certainly universal, but there also are certain things that are very particular and historical, regional, and local? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I think we've honestly lost a lot of the sense of place that probably existed in, say, the early 20th century or even mid 20th century. Americans have always been kind of a mobile people, but even more so now in the 21st century. People flocking from all over the place to move into urban centers. We know that our rural areas are depopulating. We know that if you go to, you know, New York or Washington, D.C. or any big city, you will find very few people that were born there or have even lived most of their lives there. Everyone's a transplant.
Yeah.
And so I'm afraid that a lot of that, the aspects of place are disappearing. I live here in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's the South. And very few people these days have an accent.
That's so sad.
And that's one of the charming things that makes places themselves and makes them unique,
right?
And it's disappearing. And so I don't know if in our kind of transient
moment,
metropolitan kind of culture, if place matters as much as it used to.
I don't think it does, but I also think we could, it does in a sense that we might be able to bring it back. And maybe this isn't, you know, this is just a random question of how can we fit this into the teacher education story? Because I think having an appreciation for the place in which you find yourself as a teacher and in which your students are in, and connecting them to it, would do a lot to add to that context and do a lot to add to that. What is this education for? Right. It's to make this place that I live, that I find myself in, better. Because in a lot of ways, you know, I remember growing up in Southeast Michigan and thinking that, well, education is just the way to get you out of here so you can do something else more fun. Right. But what if I had thought about education as, you know, I'm developing myself and working with those around me because I want this town that I live in to be better. This specific town, right? And that goes back to a lot of the civic education, the citizenship aspect you were getting at, right?
Right, right. And I think there is I have seen a focus on that in teacher education, because one of the things that North Carolina is trying to do in its public policy is encourage teachers to go back and teach in their hometowns, because there are not enough. The same is true for nursing. We're trying to encourage through public policy nurses to go back and be nurses in their hometowns. And so I think that that's something that's already happening kind of in the public policy of education is, you know, how can we encourage people to, you know, once they get to their to a college town, not to, you know, launch off somewhere else, but to go back home. And it's a hard question.
Yeah.
It is not one that has been solved through public policy, even though there have been attempts, strong attempts here in North Carolina to do so. The rural areas kind of continue to lose people. And it's a very hard thing to do.
North Carolina is growing, right? It's one of the states.
North Carolina as a whole is growing, but our biggest cities, Raleigh, Charlotte, Greensboro, anything along kind of transportation corridors where there are lots of jobs, those places are growing extremely quickly. And then we have rural areas that are shrinking.
Yeah.
So it's very uneven.
Right. That's true in throughout the country, I think, as well. I mean, here in Michigan, yeah, it continues to be. We're losing people, but that's different. Well, I want to is you know move toward wrapping up here. You know, what do you think are our next steps, both for the Martin Center on this, you know, this push for teacher education reform, and what would you encourage people to, you know, our audience, the folks who are researching and writing on this, what are some things that they might be able to do in researching and thinking and promoting these kinds of reforms? What are you hoping the next steps look like?
So for us, the next step is really to convince state legislators and boards of trustees that this is something that they should tackle. I think there is a tendency to want to leave this to the Department of Public Instruction or whatever that equivalent is in a given state. But I think that we've seen that these ineffective pedagogies have gotten entrenched, and this is enough of a public crisis for all of us that students can't read, that it really does need to be tackled either by legislators or by university boards. We cannot continue on this same path where teachers are not given the tools that they need to teach students how to read. And I think that, you know, something that anyone who's got a platform and a pen can do is to write about the importance of reading and make it clear that, you know, what we're doing now in our public schools is not working. I do want to do a little side note that here in North Carolina, our boards just did tackle this. And so I'm not including them in this, in the people who need to be convinced. They've already done it. Kudos to them. I'm very excited. But I think that we just need more awareness that a solution to teaching students how to read exists. We don't have to continue to see the NAEP scores go down and down and down every year. It's not inevitable. There is a solution. And it's actually, people have known it for a while. So it's just a matter of having the will to tackle this problem and to understand reading is important enough to tackle head on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Now, if anyone wants to learn more about the Martin Center, where do they go? And just kind of give you the last word there.
Absolutely. Check out our website at jamesgmartin.center. And if you're inclined, please sign up for our newsletters. We have a weekly newsletter that comes out every Friday that is kind of a digest of everything we're working on.
Excellent. Well, Jenna, it's been great to get to know you and to have this conversation. Thank you so much.
This has been great. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you. You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter as well and joining us for a future event. We're recording this episode on April 22nd, 2025, Earth Day. And if you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th, and topics related to the philosophy of education, to teacher education in general, all that. This is very much appropriate for our event, for our conference. So I encourage anyone listening, if you want to write on this and present it or propose a panel, please send it along. Let us know. And those proposals for papers and panels are due September 1st, 2025. And we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.